Applications for the Thomistic Institute's Study Abroad Program's Spring 2025 semester close on March 20th. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for college students to explore Rome's intellectual tradition at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas. Limited spots are available. For more information, visit thomisticinstitute.org/Rome. That's thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Here's the outline for the talk. So first, I will examine what the Catholic tradition says about quality of life considerations. Then I'll summarize what studies show about the ability to judge quality of life. I'll note what the AMA Code of Ethics, the American Medical Association Code of Ethics, says about quality of life considerations in healthcare decision making. At this point, I'll clarify different meanings of quality of life. Then I'll delineate the role of quality of life considerations in medical treatment decision making. And I'll conclude by reviewing responsibilities related to quality of life considerations. So to begin, there seems to be some concern in Catholic circles that quality of life judgments are inherently unethical, or at least that the language of quality of life shouldn't be used because it is tied up with advocacy for abortion, euthanasia, etc. But let's look at what Catholic teaching documents say about quality of life judgments. To begin, we'll look at Pope St. John Paul II's encyclical letter on life issues, Evangelium Vitae, 1995. And in this letter, John Paul II warns against understanding quality of life as primarily or exclusively economic efficiency, inordinate consumerism, physical beauty, and pleasure, to the neglect of the more profound dimensions, interpersonal, spiritual, and religious, of existence. And so it seems that John Paul II thinks that considerations of quality of life are not inherently problematic, but that quality of life must be rightly understood. Namely, it must include interpersonal, spiritual, and religious dimensions, as well as more physical dimensions. Later in Evangelium Vitae, he writes that the growing attention paid to quality of life is a welcome sign. So I think here it's clear that he doesn't think quality of life considerations are inherently problematic. In fact, he specifically says that paying attention to quality of life is a good thing. The Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith's 2020 letter on end-of-life ethics, Maritanus Bonus, speaks of the wrongful equating of quality of life with the value of life. It affirms the intrinsic value of every human life, contrary to the equating of quality of life and the value of the life. Like Evangelium Vitae, it emphasizes that quality of life considerations must include all dimensions of a person's life. And finally, in the document, it speaks positively about palliative care as having the goal of improving patients' quality of life. The last document I'll look at is the Pontifical Council for Pastoral Assistance to Healthcare Workers, New Charter for Healthcare Workers. And this new charter speaks of the duty of healthcare workers to improve the quality of patients' lives. Thus, it does not seem that the Catholic tradition views quality of life considerations as inherently problematic, but rather, as I've outlined, the Catholic tradition warns against reductionistic views of quality of life and against equating quality of life with the value of life. Catholic teaching, in fact, encourages attention to quality of life, especially with an eye toward the improved quality of life of persons. So if someone were to keep in view the inherent value of a person's life and avoid reducing quality of life judgments to the surface level and physical dimensions of a person's life, would it be unproblematic for that person to judge the other person's quality of life? In other words, can someone else correctly judge another's quality of life? So a review of studies related to others judging the quality of life of others shows on a whole that sometimes healthcare professionals, caregivers, etc., judge the quality of a patient's life as the patient would, and sometimes they don't. For instance, persons without disabilities, studies show, underestimate the self-reported quality of life of persons with disabilities. Another interesting point that's revealed in the studies, one study looked at healthy persons judging the quality of life of ALS patients, and this study revealed that the healthy persons tended to rate the quality of life of the ALS patients as lower if the healthy persons rated their own quality of life as lower. So there seemed to be some sort of projection of their rating of their own quality of life on how they rated the quality of life of the ALS patients. And so perhaps this is why the American Medical Association, in its Code of Medical Ethics, speaks about quality of life from the perspective of the patient, including when decisions are made by surrogate decision makers. The Code of Ethics states that surrogates should take into account the patient's quality of life as experienced by the patient. Here's how I think we can put together the Catholic tradition, the findings of studies on quality of life, and the AMA Code of Medical Ethics. First, we should distinguish quality of life from the idea of sanctity of life. So sanctity of life is a bedrock principle in the Catholic tradition, which includes the recognition of the intrinsic worth of human persons. So the idea that human persons have intrinsic worth or dignity just by virtue of being human. And so this value, this worth, is regardless of their health, abilities, relationships, even consciousness, etc. And so sickness, disability, even certain laws cannot lessen the value of a person's life. Everyone has this intrinsic worth, again, simply by virtue of being human. Sanctity of life, I think, includes both this bedrock commitment to the intrinsic worth of human persons, as well as the commitment to the view that it's morally wrong directly to take innocent human life. And this includes through direct abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and euthanasia. Even if these are motivated by quality of life considerations. And so to ask the question of the talk, are quality of life judgments ethical? Well, what I would say is not inherently, as we've seen, but if the judgment involves equating the quality of life with the value of life, then this would be morally problematic insofar as it would deny the intrinsic worth of human persons. In the same vein, if the quality of life considerations are used to justify direct abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and euthanasia, then this too would be morally problematic. Second, I would propose that we distinguish between two senses of quality of life, the first of which I'm calling an internal view of quality of life. I would define this internal view of quality of life this way: how well a person's life is going for him or her, based on, for example, physical, psychological, social, economic, and spiritual factors, and how he or she weighs these in relation to each other. Recall that the church teaching documents instruct us to include relational and spiritual dimensions in quality of life considerations. Is it unethical to make an internal judgment of one's quality of life? I would say no. I think it's appropriate to judge how well your life is going for you, and that this is important self-knowledge. At the same time, from the Catholic perspective, we have a duty to form our conscience in accord with the Catholic tradition. And so our judgments about our own quality of life ought to reflect this formation. As I've mentioned, the AMA Code of Medical Ethics agrees that quality of life is judged or ought to be judged by the person, him or herself. And so I think that this internal view of quality of life seems to be the most proper sense of quality of life. However, the phrase is also used in reference, to other people's lives. And so an external view of quality of life would be how well others think a person's life is going for him or her. But this is based primarily on observable factors. Is it unethical to judge the quality of other people's lives? I would argue that it's not necessarily unethical, especially if it's done with an eye toward improving the quality of life of others. At the same time, though, I think we need to keep in mind that we can be wrong about the quality of life of the other. We can't fully know the experience of the other person. And remember that studies corroborate this, that we don't always judge correctly the quality of life of other persons. We don't always judge their quality of life as they themselves do. Let's think about Anne again with these distinctions in mind. So first, we can affirm that Anne has the same intrinsic worth as every other human person. An external view of her quality of life seems to be what kind of the thinking was at the beginning of this talk, that Anne's quality of life is poor due to her medical conditions, G-tube, frequent hospitalizations, and limited mobility. What about her own judgment about her quality of life? Well, Anne was one of those patients that really surprised and inspired me. Anne reported that her quality of life was, on a whole, good. She mentioned that she was able to return home after each hospitalization. She was able to watch her grandchildren playing and sit at the dinner table with them. She wasn't in denial about her medical conditions, her limitations. She understood that she wasn't playing with her grandchildren. She wasn't even eating with them, as she wasn't able to take food orally safely. But still, the joy that these things brought her ability just to watch them and to sit with them, for her outweighed the negatives associated with her medical conditions. What accounts for the difference here between the internal and external senses of Anne's quality of life? Well, first, Anne has more information about her life than an outsider does. So she knows that she has grandchildren, that she lives with them, that she watches them play, that she sits at the dinner table with them. But even if an outsider had this information, the outsider might very well still judge that her quality of life is poor. Why? Because to judge another person's quality of life as they would, we need to know not only all of the different aspects of the person's life, but also how much they value these different aspects and how they weigh them in relation to each other. So again, for Anne, the ability to watch her grandchildren playing and sit at the dinner table with them is of great value, which for her outweighs the disvalue of her limitations, such that she still says her quality of life is good on a whole. Note that Anne's values have likely changed over the course of her life, such that she wouldn't always have weighed things this way. And in fact, studies show that when persons are disabled, for example, following an injury, they often report poor quality of life at first, but this changes over time as they come to accept their new limitations. So a remaining question, from a Catholic perspective, ought quality of life considerations to play any role in medical treatment decision making? I would argue that they can and do. To explain, though, let me first sketch the distinction the Catholic tradition makes between what it calls ordinary or proportionate and extraordinary or disproportionate means. It's important to understand that this distinction between ordinary and extraordinary means is a moral distinction, not a medical one. And the means or refers to medical treatment, whether to be withdrawn, so if it's already started, to stop it, or withheld, so not to start it in the first place. Ordinary means, again, in the moral sense, means that a medical treatment is morally obligatory. Extraordinary means that a medical treatment is morally optional. What makes a treatment ordinary versus extraordinary in the moral sense? The ERDs, the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Services, which is a document put out by the United States Catholic bishops that essentially summarizes and sometimes applies Catholic teaching related to bioethics. The ERDs say that proportionate means, ordinary means, are those that in the judgment of the patient offer a reasonable hope of benefit and do not entail excessive burden or impose excessive expense on the family or community. Disproportionate means, or extraordinary means, are those that in the patient's judgment do not offer a reasonable hope of benefit or entail an excessive burden or impose excessive expense on the family or the community. Note that the ERD's attention to the judgment of the patient aligns with the importance of the patient's judgment recognized by the AMA Code of Medical Ethics. So ordinary means offer a reasonable hope of benefit, and they don't entail excessive burden. Extraordinary means do not offer a reasonable hope of benefit, or they entail an excessive burden. So for ordinary means, both conditions have to be met. There has to be a reasonable hope of benefits, and there can't be an excessive burden. Extraordinary means either one, meeting either one would qualify the treatment as extraordinary. So if there's no reasonable hope of benefit or if there is an excessive burden. One way of thinking about what constitutes an excessive burden, the Catholic tradition also speaks of weighing benefits and burdens. And so when burdens are proportionate to the benefits, when they are not weightier than the benefits, then the treatment would be ordinary or, again, proportionate. When the burdens are disproportionate to the benefits, so when the burdens outweigh the benefits, then the treatment would be disproportionate, extraordinary means. A few notes about the benefits and the burdens that the Catholic tradition instructs us to attend to here. So first, the consideration is of the benefits and the burdens of the treatment itself, not of the patient's life. So consider a child with significant disabilities who will never walk or talk, who develops appendicitis and needs surgery. It would be wrong to forgo the surgery on the basis that the child needs significant care or that the child's life involves many burdens, both to the child and to others. The need for care in this case is not the result of the treatment, the surgery itself. And so to consider whether the surgery is ordinary or extraordinary for this particular child in this particular circumstance, we would need to consider the benefits and the burdens of the surgery for this particular child in the particular circumstance. But in other ways, benefits and burdens, there's a broad sense of benefit and burden in the Catholic tradition. So first, you can see here in the quotes from the ERDs that consideration is not just to the benefits and the burdens to the patient, but also to the family and the community. Along the same lines, the consideration of benefits and burdens includes not just medical benefits and burdens, but also psychological, social, economic, spiritual benefits and burdens as well. So where does quality of life fit in? Recall that benefits and burdens are of the treatment itself, not the patient's life, but aspects of the patient's life must be considered in order to consider what the benefits and burdens of the treatment will be for that patient. Aspects of the patient's life, including the quality of the patient's life. I think it's important to consider how a particular treatment affects or will affect the quality of life of a patient, family, community. To be clear, again, it's not the case that we can decide not to proceed with a treatment because the patient has a poor quality of life. But we can decide not to do a treatment, or we may decide not to do a treatment, because there is not sufficient benefit. In other words, because it doesn't maintain or improve the quality of life in comparison to the burdens, in comparison to how it detracts from the patient's quality of life. So to go back to the example of antibiotics, in the case of someone imminently dying from another cause, as we said, we likely wouldn't see a benefit before death, but the burdens would likely involve worse quality of life in the hours or days before death due to the side effects of the antibiotics. I'd like to conclude with what I'm calling quality of life pro tips. We've distinguished sanctity of life from quality of life, as well as internal and external views of quality of life. As I said, it doesn't seem unethical to make quality of life judgments about oneself or others, but the Catholic tradition and the medical literature point us to some responsibilities related to quality of life judgments. So first, as John Paul II and the CDF teach, we shouldn't leave relational and spiritual dimensions out of quality of life considerations. Secondly, as the CDF warns, we shouldn't equate the worth of a person with his or her quality of life. Third, we shouldn't judge that direct abortion, physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia are morally permissible for those who won't or don't have a sufficiently good quality of life. Fourth, we should make internal quality of life judgments with a formed conscience. With respect to external quality of life judgments, recall that studies show that we do not always judge the quality of life of others as they themselves judge their own quality of life. And so we need to have epistemic humility about our external quality of life judgments. It's also important, I think, to ask the other person questions to learn more about his or her life so that we can make a more accurate judgment. I also think that it's important to keep in mind that both the patient and the professional, the healthcare professional, bring important information to the table. So if we're talking about quality of life judgments in the medical setting, only the patient knows the details of the patient's life, but the professional too has expertise about the patient's medical condition, risks and side effects of treatment, etc. And so I do think that there is a place for the healthcare professional to relay his or her external judgments to the patient, but it does seem to me that it's best to avoid quality of life language here. Rather, my recommendation would be to use more specific language. So, for example, the healthcare professional could talk about the ability of the patient to participate in activities of daily living. The healthcare professional could speak about the medical benefits and burdens of treatment, etc. So, in sum on this point, I think it's best to use quality of life language when we're talking about our own quality of life or when we're asking how we can improve someone else's quality of life, but to use more specific language related to the expertise of the healthcare professional when we're talking about the quality of life of the patient. Did I just lose that now? Oh, there we go, we're back, okay. Regarding quality of life judgments and medical treatment decision-making, we should not judge that a medical treatment should not be pursued merely on the basis that a person does not have a sufficiently good quality of life. But at the same time, if we're heeding the other pro tips above, we should, I think, consider positive and negative impacts of treatment on quality of life when considering the benefits and burdens of treatment, and so when discerning whether a treatment is ordinary or extraordinary. I'll leave you with this pro tip. So regardless of a decision to pursue a particular treatment, I think it's important to ask, how can we improve this person's quality of life? And how can we help this person to express or experience his or her intrinsic worth as a person? The ERDs say precisely that the care provided assists those in need to experience their own dignity and value. Samaritanus Bonus speaks really beautifully about the intrinsic worth of human persons, regardless of their medical conditions. It says that whatever their physical or psychological condition, human persons always retain their original dignity as created in the image of God. They can live and grow in the divine splendor because they are called to exist in the image and glory of God.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.